Today, we look at Keir Starmer's approach so far as Labour leader and ask, is it working?
We've just had a result. The Press Association has said that Keir Starmer has been elected the next leader of the Labour Party. They have snapped it. Somehow.
It was the strangest time to become a Labour leader.
He succeeds Jeremy Corbyn as leader of Her Majesty's opposition.
Keir Starmer couldn't even attend his own victory party. Instead, he had to pre-record an acceptance speech.
It is the honour and the privilege of my life to be elected as leader of the Labour Party. It comes at a moment like none other in our lifetime.
Then there was no Parliament to debate in. Instead, Starmer had to watch Boris Johnson's approval ratings surge as the Prime Minister used daily press conferences to place the country into lockdown.
You must stay at home.
And announce plans to pay millions of people's wages.
And to all of them, we in government say we will stand by you.
But since then, things have changed. Questions about the failure to act quickly enough, a rising death rate.
The UK has now become the first country in Europe to record more than 30,000 deaths.
And a shrinking economy has caused support for the government to fall steeply.
We've had crossover. For the first time, more people think the government are doing badly than say that they're doing well.
How are you going to handle the new Labour leader, Prime Minister?
But can the official opposition provide an alternative that voters want? From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, after Corbynism, how is Keir Starmer changing the Labour Party? Heather Stewart, political editor at The Guardian. Tell me, how did Keir Starmer pitch himself during the leadership campaign?
Well, it was very careful and very sort of thought through, as everything is with Keir Starmer.
The dedication of our commitment of our members together. We're unstoppable when we're united.
He was very keen to underline the fact that his policies, his politics are quite similar to Jeremy Corbyn's. So he made these 10 pledges to Labour members, and they included, you know, getting rid of universal credit and supporting the abolition of tuition fees. He talked about party unity, and he talked about moving on from Brexit.
We can't now let Brexit tear our party apart for the next 10 or 20 years. So we need to come together.
Really, it was very much a sort of left of centre pitch, I would say.
You mentioned unity. He said repeatedly, I would say, that he wanted to have a team when he came in that would represent all sides of the party. But when he did come in, I don't know if it was just me, but he did seem to sack a lot of Corbynites.
He did. It was quite a ruthless reshuffle, I would say. He certainly swept away a lot of those people in the shadow cabinet that we had come to be quite familiar with. So Ian Lavery and John Trickett, and Diane Abbott had already said she would go. She's sort of part of Jeremy's team. But Richard Bergen, John McDonnell, again, had said he would go too. But, you know, you look across the front bench and there's very few remnants of that regime, really, apart from Rebecca Long-Bailey, really, who's shadow education secretary, who he kind of had to give a big job to, really, because she was one of his defeated rivals. So it looks very different. I mean, someone who was on the shadow front bench said to me the other day, he wants to bury Corbynism, was the feeling that they had about it. It was a real a clean sweep.
What, somebody who was on the Corbyn side of the party said that?
Yes, indeed.
Now, the new appointments are these. David Lammy, a comeback for him, Shadow Justice Secretary. John Healey moves to Shadow Defence Secretary.
If you actually look at the makeup of his new team, it includes fewer people from what you would call the sort of left wing of the Labour Party, but also not that many people from what you might call the right wing, or maybe the Blairite wing, if that's such a still a thing.
Ed Miliband. Emily Thornberry moves from Shadow Foreign Secretary to International Trade.
Which is quite Reynolds. Interesting, because people have long looked at Keir Starmer and wondered, where does he fit in this sort of patchwork of caucuses and interest groups that you have within the Labour Party? And, you know, the truth is he's sort of on the soft left of the party, but not in any of those kinds of groups.
It's interesting if a Corbyn supporter within Parliament was suggesting that Keir Starmer was trying to bury Corbynism, because a lot of people would argue that whatever happens in Parliament, Labour's membership had shifted through the Corbyn years, and also its ruling executive had shifted, which meant that even if the man himself went, Corbynism would survive. But some of that has changed as well, hasn't it?
Yeah, and quite quickly. So it took Jeremy Corbyn a long time, more than a year, to get to the point where he could safely have a majority on the National Executive Committee, the NEC, which is Labour's ruling body. It makes loads of important decisions about how the party works. It took him a long time to get a majority. Well, Keir Starmer pretty much has a majority already. Also, very importantly, he now has his own General Secretary. And again, it took Jeremy Corbyn quite a long time. He had to fight a general election with a general secretary he hadn't chosen. So it's been quite a radical transformation in a short time. Having said that, though, you know, there's nothing in Keir Starmer's prospectus as set out that points to a shift to the right very dramatically. And he's certainly not ditching great swathes of Corbynite policy, I would say, but certainly the personnel are very different.
So quite a contrast with Jeremy Corbyn then, who did seem to have problems with senior staff in Labour headquarters. As you say, he didn't move them out quickly, but leaks have suggested that some were very, very hostile towards his leadership. Starmer instead has had a very quick changing of the guard. That's his team. Tell me, what was one of the first things he did when he became leader?
Well, actually, immediately he came to power. I think I'm right in saying on the day that he won the leadership election, he wrote to Jewish groups and talked about Labour's record on anti-Semitism and said he wanted to meet them and he wanted to work with them.
Anti-Semitism has been a stain on our party. I have seen the grief that it's brought to so many Jewish communities.
He's been quite outspoken on this issue during Jeremy Corbyn's leadership, and he clearly wanted to sort of, you know, draw a line in the sand and show that he was someone who was going to approach this differently.
On behalf of the Labour Party, I am sorry.
There's, of course, the Equality and Human Rights Commission, EHRC report on this coming up probably quite soon, we think, which may or may not show that Labour is institutionally anti-Semitic. But he certainly wanted to show that this was a clean sheet as far as that particular issue was concerned.
But of course, the thing that was really dramatic, and not just when he became leader, it had already derailed Labour's leadership contest in many ways, was the fact that Britain had been plunged into the greatest health crisis that we've known for decades. Obviously, the first few weeks in the job as Labour leader is where you set the tone. And for Starmer, that has meant setting the tone right in the middle of this COVID crisis. How did he go about responding to it?
It's been much harder for him to make his mark on the party, I think, than it would be for a new leader who could, you know, hold speeches or rallies or big public events, which would be quite symbolic of which direction they wanted to take the party in. And where he can't even go out to key constituencies and sort of meet people there. He runs things very, very differently. He's much more like a sort of chairman than Jeremy Corbyn was. People have said he sort of says to front benches, look, you don't have to speak just for the sake of it in a meeting. You know, only join in if you've got something sort of useful to say, and let's be very businesslike about it. And this is your job, and this is your role, and this is your role.
We've got to be constructive. We've got to pull together, support the government where it's right to do so.
Early on, I think the polling was telling Labour, and in fact, you could sort of sense it in the mood when you spoke to people, that actually this was a huge national crisis. People wanted to see politicians sort of pulling together. They wanted this sense that it was a national effort. There was a lot of sort of solidarity, pulling together and sort of collectivism. And so you had this stance from Labour, which it was really quite a supportive stance, and, you know, he's happy to be briefed by the Prime Minister.
Well, I spoke to the Prime Minister yesterday. We agreed arrangements between ourselves going forward for the next few weeks, and we'll operate to those arrangements.
And generally took this supportive tone to start with.
And so, of course, we'll push the government on that, but we push the government not to score a point, but we push the government to protect lives and protect our country and protect our front line.
I guess the first place we look to judge the performance of the Leader of the Opposition is in Prime Minister's questions every Wednesday, something that you obviously watch every week. Tell me how that's changed.
So under Jeremy Corbyn, it was a moment where you felt that what the Labour leader was doing was kind of channeling the anger and the passions of the public.
He's desperate, absolutely desperate to avoid scrutiny.
So it was often quite rowdy. Of course, at that time, you had a sort of full House of MPs behind both of the participants, which at the moment you don't have because of social distancing. But there was often quite a sort of passionate moment, which afterwards would be clipped up for social media and you would see people sharing it very enthusiastically.
Which foodstuffs are not going to be available? Which medicines are not going to be supplied?
People who felt furious with the government's performance, this was a moment in the week at which Labour got to sort of point it out. And there were particular themes that Jeremy Corbyn liked to come back to over and over again. And you know, Boris Johnson got quite used to that.
He has no plan to get a new deal, no plan, no authority and no majority.
He also knew Jeremy Corbyn's back catalogue very well, his somewhat controversial back catalogue. And so he could always throw a prepared line at Jeremy Corbyn about his sort of foreign policy record and to some extent try and diffuse the more serious points at hand.
We think that the friends of this country are to be found in Paris and in Berlin and in the White House. And he thinks that they're in the Kremlin and in Tehran and in...
It's very different under Keir Starmer.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Can I welcome the Prime Minister back to his place and say that it's good to see him back in Parliament? I'm sure I speak for all of us when I say that.
It's become almost a cliché to say that he's forensic.
Mr. Speaker, the argument that international comparisons can't really be made when the government's been using slides like this for weeks to do international comparison just really doesn't hold water.
It's the sort of such a cliche that, in fact, that Boris Johnson sort of teased him about it himself last week.
One brief one day, another brief the next. I know, I understand how the legal profession works, but what the public want to have is some consistency.
But it's much, much calmer, and it's quiet, and it's careful, and it tends to focus on details. He has always prepared incredibly well, or that's the way it seems, and it seems to be quite effective against Boris Johnson, who is not great at details and tends to sort of bluster. Of recent weeks, it's become increasingly a powerful contest, really, between them, I think.
They built the Nightingale hospitals. Why are they only starting on schools now?
Mr. Speaker, he still can't work out whether he's saying schools are not safe enough or whether we should be going back more quickly. I mean,
and a moment when Starmer wants to underline the seriousness of the situation that we face, not least by pointing very carefully every week to the death figures that we've all sort of climbing and climbing, and you almost sort of lose the sense of how shocking they are, really. But actually, when you hear them read out in that very serious, careful tone in the Commons, it reminds you how shocking it is.
But yesterday, we learnt, tragically, that at least 29,427 people in the UK have now lost their lives to this dreadful virus.
And it sort of makes it very difficult for Johnson then either to use jokes or humour or lightheartedness or to sort of jolly things up. You know, you can't do that in the face of that sort of very serious attack. And it does seem to needle Johnson. He does seem to get irritable sometimes. And, you know, and there have also been occasions where Starmer has pointed out mistakes that Johnson has made. So they had a to-ing and fro-ing, an exchange of letters the other week about care homes, about the advice that was given to care homes and to hospitals about discharging patients to care homes.
And I quote, "Negative tests are not required prior to transfers or admissions into care homes." What's protective about that?
Keir Starmer said that Johnson had misrepresented what had happened, and Starmer sort of shot back in another letter that he was playing politics.
Of course, he's right to draw attention to what has happened in our care homes, and we mourn the loss of every victim, but no one...
It seems to have a cumulative effect on Johnson, and it seems to make him feel quite uncomfortable, I would say.
And I imagine that Labour members quite like that when they think that it's working, whether it's about care homes or death rates. But do they get frustrated when, say, for example, you get a very Keir Starmer-like response over the Dominic Cummings affair, when everyone's really quite angry and he's still quite restrained?
Yeah, there's definitely been a few times, a sense in recent weeks, certainly the MPs have felt, why aren't we saying more? Why aren't we speaking up more? They're hearing a lot of anger from constituents and they're wondering why Labour is not sort of channeling that anger and is not sort of, you know, shouting from the rooftops about some of those things. You know, this sort of rather careful, earnest approach doesn't suit everybody. And there are certainly MPs who would like to hear Labour being angrier and making its voice heard more.
Is that measured forensic approach a tactic, or is that just Keir Starmer's nature?
I do think it's a bit of both. So watching the way that Starmer handled the Brexit debate within the Labour Party. And looking back on it, as I've done to sort of write longer term pieces about some of these things, every step was carefully thought through. And everything he said was said with a view to how it might look in 6 or 9 months' time. So he's very keen to get this message out there at the moment that Labour feels the government moved too slow.
I've been concerned the government was slow into lockdown, slow on testing, slow on protective equipment, and may now well be slow on an exit strategy.
They're wondering to themselves, when we look back on this in 6 months or a year time, what will we think? And probably the overriding message may well be, certainly what the scientific experts think, we were too slow to act.
I don't think we've been moving quickly enough on tests and on protective equipment.
And I think he thinks if he is saying it seriously and over again, almost repetitively now.
The planning wasn't as good as it should have been. We all know the testing has gone badly wrong.
People will remember, okay, yeah, he was the guy who kind of called this.
If we're to avoid that sort of thing again, we do now need the exit strategy. So
it's absolutely his style to behave and to speak in this kind of way, but I also think there is method in it, and it's all very carefully focus grouped and thought about from the point of view of what the voter is looking at and thinking. And I should say also, he is front and centre of their sort of media package at the moment, partly because they think the public don't necessarily know who he is, and so they are very much trying to get him up there. And when they do get him up there, he hammers home his message.
Coming up, a change of tone from the Labour leader, who thinks that getting on the front of the Daily Telegraph might help him get elected. Okay, so that's style, if you like, the way in which Starmer is talking, which is clearly quite a contrast to Corbyn before him. I mean, the other big challenge for him is obviously to understand why Labour did so badly across its so-called red wall seats, those former heartlands in the North and the Midlands. Are there specific things about what they say that they think needs to change to try to appeal to those voters?
So one thing I think is to sound and to appear more sort of patriotic. I remember you and I interviewing Jeremy Corbyn during the 2017 general election, and he was furious about the idea that he didn't love Britain or wasn't patriotic, or however you would put it. But there was a feeling that because he was a bit of a pacifist, you know, he wasn't particularly proud of a particular kind of Britishness. Corbyn would certainly have denied that. But Keir Starmer is determined to take a sort of slightly different approach. And you could really see that in a big symbolic way on the front page of the Daily Telegraph, obviously not a Labour-supporting paper, very much not, on VE Day.
And we remember the millions of people from across the United Kingdom and from across the world who came together in World War II to fight for our shared values.
Keir Starmer had written this piece for The Telegraph where he linked VE Day and veterans and the treatment of the care homes issue and the fact that care homes have been sort of hotbeds of coronavirus and that hasn't been very well dealt with.
Theirs is an incredible legacy. The National Health Service, the welfare state, the recognition of human rights.
Even to see the Labour leader on the front of the Daily Telegraph with a sort of supportive piece would have seemed pretty extraordinary in the Jeremy Corbyn era. It just wasn't something that happened. So that was one sign, I think, that Starmer wants to reach beyond the groups. Another one you could highlight was the anniversary of the murder of Lee Rigby by extremists, which again Keir Starmer tweeted about, saying we will never forget him or waver in our commitment to tackling violent extremism and hate. A tougher stance, I would say, on some of those issues. And certainly when you speak to MPs or former MPs in some of those constituencies, those red wall constituencies, they say, you know, voters want to hear more from us about tackling crime and about law and order and some of those issues that weren't so high up the agenda for Jeremy Corbyn's Labour.
I guess trying to strike that tone became something that was much more sensitive when the Black Lives Matter protests began, because Starmer, obviously, not least because of his own history, would support protesters talking about racism. But he then had to make a decision on how to handle statues being pulled down. What did he say on that?
Well, that was very interesting because it's a kind of test, isn't it, of where you put yourself on some of these culture war issues. He was doing an LBC phone-in.
Call Keir. Put your questions to the leader of the Labour Party. Say Keir Starmer now.
Which, again, was not something we saw Jeremy Corbyn doing, just chatting to people who'd phoned in.
What would you do to address the institutional racism within the judicial system?
Well, stay on the line, Alex. So, Keir.
Alex, look, thanks for raising that.
Obviously. And he was asked about it, and he said it was completely wrong that the statue had been pulled down in that way.
Yeah, shouldn't have been done in that way. Completely wrong to pull a statue down like that.
He also said it shouldn't have still been there.
That statue should have been brought down a long time, should have been taken down a long, long time ago.
This debate had been going on for ages. It should have come down, but it should have come down in a sort of democratic way. He was sort of refusing to be pigeonholed, I suppose, in a way. Downing Street would love to fight some of these culture war battles with Labour firmly on the other side. They believe that lots of voters in exactly those sort of red wall seats are not terribly interested in these kinds of issues, think they're a bit of a distraction. So he's been very careful on some of these issues. And you can tell how thought through it is because, you know, later that same day, the Shadow Home Secretary, Nick Thomas Symonds, was up in the House of Commons and used very, very similar language.
And not that it should need saying, but Black Lives Matter.
He wasn't sorry to see that the statue to a slave owner had come down, but on the other hand, you know, he couldn't support the fact that it had been torn down.
What is never the solution, though, Madam Deputy Speaker, is violence and vandalism.
And he also made a point of asking the Home Secretary, you know, how are the police officers who were injured in that demonstration?
And I hope the Home Secretary will update us on the condition of the 27 officers injured.
We, Labour, don't support that kind of behaviour. So it's nuanced and it's careful and it's trying not to be shoved on one side of the issue or the other, because that's not where Labour wants to put itself. You know, that doesn't go down terribly well with some Labour backbenchers who feel incredibly strongly about these things and think it is a sort of overriding issue and that Labour should be more strident and more outspoken on it.
When they're thinking about this, if they are thinking about it as carefully as you're saying, it seems to me from watching Shadow Cabinet members on the television, listening to them on the radio, that they are very, very careful about how they talk about Winston Churchill.
Winston Churchill stood in Parliament prior to the war. He was one of the only MPs speaking out against appeasement. He then, after Chamberlain resigned, became leader and led a coalition government that defeated fascism. And for all of those reasons, he's hugely respected. So I wouldn't support his statue coming down. But I recognise, of course, there's a debate about what he did in Bengal with the famine, what he did in the Tony Pandy riots. And I
Yeah, and understandably so. You know, Boris Johnson's written this piece in The Telegraph in which he says he'll fight with the last breath in his body to prevent anybody removing the statue of Churchill that was covered up at the weekend. But nobody has called, as far as I know, for Churchill's statue to come down. Labour certainly haven't. I don't think any other opposition party have either. So I think the Tories would love to drag Labour into that sort of territory, exactly because of these reasons we've talked about patriotism. They would love to suggest it's Labour that would denigrate the reputation of Winston Churchill and that, you know, that would quite like to go through the Light Entertainment back catalogue to see if there are any episodes of 40 Towers that they don't like the look of. But Keir Starmer's Labour Party are not in that territory and they're not interested in that sort of row. They're interested in the sort of policies. You know, they're saying, why haven't you implemented the Lammy review of how black people fare in the justice system? And they're saying, why haven't you implemented the Windrush review?
But isn't there a potential problem for Keir Starmer here as well? That while what he may be doing is recognising that there is a culture war and one that has divided opinion across Labour's long-held coalition of voters, attempting to straddle it could infuriate those who want him to take a tougher stance on racism and our racist past.
Yeah, it's a different version of the terrible dilemma Labour face with Brexit, isn't it? Brexit was another issue that sort of drove a coach and horses through Labour's potential governing coalition. Some of these identity issues or culture war issues are also really problematic. And yes, of course, there will be people who want Labour to take a much stronger stance. And actually, you know, Keir Starmer's path to number 10 probably involves trying to win back some of those red wall seats. But also, if you look at the list of Labour targets, you know, also on it are seats like Chipping Barnet and seats like Kensington and, you know, some of these sort of metropolitan seats where these culture war issues play very, very strongly. So it's not easy for him, I don't think.
What you're saying is Keir Starmer came into power by pitching himself, in policy terms at least, not that far from Corbyn. But since he's been leader of the opposition, his style has been very, very different, from a kind of more consensual take over COVID to start with, a more forensic manner in the chamber, and a attempt to reach out across that culture war divide. It's early days, but can we judge yet whether what he's doing is working?
So a Mori poll last week suggested he was the most popular opposition leader since Tony Blair. Of course, it's very early days, and goodness knows the backdrop could change an awful lot between now and 2024. But there are some signs, at least, that in the public's mind, he's not doing too badly.
It's very striking that he's doing so well in terms of personal approval ratings. But this has been a terrible time for the government, hasn't it? It's not just Labour that has revealed how poorly they've handled the COVID crisis.
Generally, the polling of the opposition tends to go up when the government's having a torrid time. And it's quite hard to look at the government's performance in the last 6 months and say it's gone well, isn't it? So, you know, it's, to some extent, Starmer is being a sort of lightning rod, or he's kind of channeling the feelings that the public have. And we know the public are increasingly disgruntled with the government's handling of coronavirus, and particularly the Dominic Cummings issue. What will be very interesting, I think, is when we start to see a bit more what Starmerism is. So, you know, one of the sort of Corbynite backbenchers was saying this to me last week. You had a sense of what Corbynism was. It had deep roots. You know, he came from a particular group, the campaign group of MPs. You knew what they thought the same things about most issues for 30 odd years. You knew what the point of it was. What is Starmerism? What policies will he be promulgating? How do we get a sense of what he actually stands for? And I'm not sure many people yet know the answer to that.
Heather Stewart, thank you very much.
Thanks, Anoushka.
That was Heather Stewart, The Guardian's political editor. Do follow her on Twitter, @GuardianHeather, and read her reporting and that of the entire Westminster team at theguardian.com. Do also follow Andrew Sparrow's brilliant political live blog. If you have any thoughts or feedback about Today in Focus, do tweet me @AnoushkaAstana. That's it for today. My thanks to Heather Stewart. This episode was produced by Serena Barker-Singh and Hannah Moore. Sound design was by Nicholas Cox. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.